Good evening. This is Hotline. You're probably aware of the existence of the so-called hotline between London, Washington and Moscow, and all of us at some time or another have longed for the chance of meeting famous men and women and putting to them our pet questions. This is the program that gives you the opportunity, for we have a hotline into this studio, and here to answer questions sent in by you, the viewers, are four famous people, each of whom is preeminent in his or her own field.
Ha! Sadly, as you'll hear, the preeminence of Peter Ustinov, Jeanette Spanier, Pietro Annigoni, Randolph Churchill and David Jacobs was not matched by the telecom engineering. Hotline was the BBC's first phone-in, born on television on May 15, 1965, and axed on May 22, 1965. It wasn't so much a magic moment as a half-cock hour, and not a proper phone-in, but a phone-out. You sent in a card and hoped to be rung and given the chance to pose pet questions to famous men and women. David Jacobs told viewers not to call in, since national switchboards would be jammed and essential services endangered. OK, let it roll.
Hello, Peter.
Hello, dear.
Do men who grow beards suffer from an inferiority complex?
Before or after they've grown their beard?
Hello?
Before or after they've grown the beard?
Don't shut the door, John. I can't hear you.
He's got a beard, don't you?
Has John got a beard or not?
Pete, have you got something to ask me?
Has John got a beard? No, John. John.
He should be asleep, really, but I'll let him stay up.
Lucky John. After that disaster, the BBC ditched dial-ins until 1968. It was an era of change in radio. The success of the pop pirate stations provided the catalyst for the BBC to launch both Radio 1 and local radio. One of the first stations was Radio Nottingham, which charged its DJs with finding a new, cheap way of allowing listeners access to their airwaves. Tony Church was one of them.
Among us, we thought, well, one way of giving the people this voice, the local people, was a very logical one. Instead of getting them to drag into the studio, always to talk, or going out and doing vox pops on the street, sticking microphones under their noses, one very logical way of extending the discussion program, as it was then called, was the idea that they could ring in to express their views in the middle of the discussion. And so we thought about this a little bit and gave it a trial run in the office at the old place with sort of fake ringers in on office phones. And so that's really, we knew it would work.
Radio Nottingham on VHF 94.8 and Rediffusion Channel C. Remember our slogan, tune in and listen, come in and take part.
The very first programme we did was called What Are They Up To Now? They, being the authorities, the people who made decisions. Very confrontational sort of programme, the idea being that if the council was failing to mend your leaky roof, was charging you too much rent for whatever, they, the decision makers, the people who to some extent dictated your life, were answerable. They came into the studio, you could ring them and give them a hard time. That was basically the idea of what are they up to now. A curious thing was that we were financed in part at the beginning, when it was the local radio experiment, by the local council. And here we had the people who put in the money into the kitty being made the Aunt Sally's of a programme they were helping to finance. It was like, now a word from our sponsor and you can kick him in the teeth.
I have offered to Mr. Goslin and to Mrs. Smith and to the Ratepayers Association that any time I can be of any service to them, I will be there. And I haven't had any communication from them at all about these rats. So this is a lot of poppycock.
Can we interrupt you a moment? Because we have a listener on the phone to us all here, and it's Mr. Preston of Woodborough Road. What's your point, Mr. Preston?
Just wanted to say that we have had this problem. We have had rats.
It was very much part of the democratic process. And I think it did change people's perception of the BBC. It also changed people's feelings about broadcasting in general. They suddenly could get their 5 minutes of fame, or if they really bent your ear occasionally, they're 10 minutes of fame, and they could do it very easily. They would ring in ostensibly about what the programme was supposed to be about, but would then develop it to ride their own hobby horse in a fairly unstoppable fashion. And something that became a running preoccupation was dogs fouling the footpath. It didn't matter whether you were having a phone-in about whether we should celebrate Christmas in a more Christian fashion or whether the council should get around to mending council house roofs. Still somebody would say, but before we start on that, I'd like to tell you about the dogs fouling the footpath.
Already listeners were beginning to exercise control over what was broadcast, shaping programmes in a way unforeseen by nervous BBC management. When local commercial radio was launched in the early 70s, the phone-in was a key part of its output. In 1974, Anna Raeburn joined London's Capital Radio as an airborne agony aunt.
Radio has, I believe, unique advantages as a medium because it doesn't have that damned image. You aren't clogged up with what people look like. You make your own pictures. And really, people did, to a very large extent in my experience, suspend the notion of who was listening. They phoned Anna or the Capital Doctor or Sarah Ward or Brian Hayes or whoever it was and spoke. And that, believe me, was my conviction too. I'm dealing with you. The rest of them are eavesdropping, and you know what they say about eavesdroppers, they often learn something very informative about themselves.
Stuart's joined us now. Stuart, good evening.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, I've got a little problem. I'm happily married with two kids, and I had a phone call a couple of days ago from a bird I was seeing, and she told me she's pregnant.
Mm.
I just don't know what to do about it.
Well, how come you call yourself happily married with two kids and then say you've had a bird you were seeing and she thinks she's pregnant? Is she pregnant by you?
Yes.
What are you going to do about it?
Well, I'm ringing up, so I don't really know what to do. So
well, does your wife know that you are unfaithful to her?
Yeah, well, the problem is, cause I'm trying to be faithful to my wife, and I really want to tell her about that I had a little affair on the side. It's been truthful.
But how long ago did the affair end?
Well, it was about 10 months ago.
I must say that I would never call a phone-in programme. But then that's the ultimate state with a middle-class informed. You know, if I have a legal problem, I go to a solicitor. If I have a medical problem, I go to a doctor. If I have a psychiatric problem, I go to a shrink. The charm for them was that I wasn't a shrink, a doctor, a barrister. I was a person.
All right, why wouldn't you ring a phone-in?
Because I come from a background which always suggested to me that there was a professional answer, but an awful lot of the people who rang me had tried the professional answer and found it sadly lacking, or so long-term, that it wasn't going anywhere. And I think anyway, one began with an absolute commitment that I was there as a middleman. I was there to push people in a certain direction, and I think I spent 80% of my radio time on that programme over 14 years, sending people back into exactly the transaction that they were initially trying to involve, having to say that you're going to have to see the doctor. I can't examine it.
One of Raeburn's early colleagues at Capital was Brian Hayes, who moved soon afterwards to the London talks and news station, LBC. Hayes didn't sucker souls, search psyches, or examine hang-ups. He questioned callers' opinions, made them justify themselves. He has been called rude.
Good morning, Brian. I just want to speak about Mrs. Thatcher with the Russians covering up. Now, she should be the last person on earth to talk about covering up. Every mistake she's made, she's covered up. There was the Falklands, there was the steel, there was the coal, there was the health, there was the rovers, unemployment, health, hospitals.
See, if they were all covered up, how do you know about them?
Oh, Brian, there's loads of things. Look at the unemployment figures she's covered up. The hospital, she said, the health people, she was there to help.
Yeah, I think you're talking through the back of your head, but then that's up to you. 20 minutes past 10. I suppose I must have been over the years at some stage, or several stages, rude. It's not a deliberate intention to be rude. It is really pushing an argument or a situation to move the programme on. I've always shied clear of that business that if somebody rings in and says, you know, I'm 75 and I fought in two world wars and you've no right to speak to me like that, I have no patience with that, because I think that if I responded to that in the way they wanted me to respond to that, I would end up being patronising. I would be saying, yes, yes, of course, you fought the war, and therefore what you say is very, very important, and all that. It's no more or less important than what somebody else has to say. The strength of your argument comes out in the strength of your argument, not the fact that you fought two world wars. Now, that applies to all kinds of categories of people, whether somebody is
black. He's disadvantaged physically or mentally. All kinds of things people might use as a kind of lever in an argument. Okay, they can try it. It's my job to actually see through it and get underneath that and find out what they're actually saying, or more importantly, I suppose, what they're thinking.
I can't listen to his radio programme.
You can't?
It makes me throw up.
Why?
I'm not interested in listening to people being hateful to each other. I don't respect it as journalism. I don't respect it as a way of earning a living. I just don't respect it.
Well, if Anna Raban thinks that of the soft South Brian Hayes, I wonder what you would think of Alan Bezick.
I'll do Ruth.
Just fine to say, Alan, I think it's disgusting the way you cut people off.
Pardon? I'll do Stephen.
I'll do Alan. I've got a joke for you.
Have you? Well, ring me back and tell it, but don't warn me. I'll do Peter.
Oh, hello, Alan. Thank God I got through early. At least I can get a good night's sleep tonight.
I'm glad to hear it. Well, get your head down. I'll do David.
Hello, Alan. Can I have a bit of advice, please?
Yeah, don't go with mucky women. I'll do Stephen.
Hello?
Yes?
Is that you, Alan?
No, he's gone home. I'll do Tommy.
Hello?
Yes?
I'd like to talk about Manchester United.
Well, you can't.
Bezick now runs a phone-in free breakfast show on Manchester's GMR, but he used to host a late-night slot on Lancashire's Red Rose Radio, where he perfected his abrasive style. Weren't the listeners offended?
We have, at GMR at the moment, we have a woman working on a programme, and she came up to me, you perhaps don't believe it, about half an hour ago, and said, I want to tell you about my little brother. My little brother was 12 years of age, and he spent a fortnight trying to ring you at Red Rose Radio. He had a particular idea about a political party, and he wanted to discuss it with you. And he got through after a fortnight of ringing, and you said, with a squeaky voice like that, you're too young to be up at this time of night. Get off and don't ever come back for the next 10 years. And it was the highlight of his year. I mean, he was absolutely... He went round and said, Alan Bezick's been rude to me, which is wonderful. So the most frequent response was warmth.
Usually the newspaper, when they get a subject that's discussed at some length, a lot of letters, eventually get the editor putting a note in, correspondence on this subject has now ceased. Do you think perhaps it's time to do the same with this abortion business, which
nope.
is going on for so long? It's gone
nope.
on for so many months now.
You've still got an answer. The answer's no.
All right, then. Can we stop it, then? Is it finished now?
No, but you can end this little bit. I will decide what has ended on this programme.
Yes.
But if you do not wish a subject to continue, then perhaps the best way is to keep your mouth shut.
Well, you've got to lose all your listeners, do it, then.
Well, Ted...
We're all fed up with this.
Ted,
go on for
Ted,
hours
Ted,
hours.
Who elected you as the listener's spokesman?
Who elected you?
Nobody, but I have to decide. I choose to decide what I'll do on this show. And I don't give a monkey's cuss whether it gets up your nose or not.
There is so much on the radio, television, particularly politicians and other broadcasters. They're full of... I nearly said a naughty word, but it's probably not true anyway. But they're full of syrup. They want to take all the edges off everything and dilute it down into basically nothing. And when somebody comes along, even if you don't agree with them and says, this is my opinion, shove it up your nose whether you like it or not, people actually say, yeah, good on you, mate. I don't agree with you, but good on you, mate.
I'll do to Cliff. You must be Eileen Dover. Hello to John. How are you that, John?
One of the high points for me was the wit of callers and the way the phoning works, just in physical terms. I would have a pair of cans on and talk into a microphone. Everything else was done next door. And I would finish with one call and go to the next one. Just simply say, thanks very much, Charlie. And as I said, thanks very much, Charlie, a voice in my ear said, Fred. And I said, I'll do Fred. And there was a wonderful time when we'd had about 30 Scousers on in a row, and I'd cut them all off for being Scousers. And I said, I'm sorry, mate, I'm not talking to no Scousers tonight. Get off. Cut him off. The voice said in my ear, Dare. And I said, hello, Dare. And a Scouser said, thanks very much, Alan. Good night. So those are the highlights, because that guy must have planned that in the pub. The night, I'm going to get him tonight, you know. And he did it, and that's wonderful. The other highlights is a call, I suppose it's a low light as much as a highlight, but it was a call that went on for 2¾ hours. A woman said she was going to commit suicide, and whether she was or not, I don't know. It may have been the biggest hoax of all time, I don't know. In truth, don't really care. I believed her for the moment and spent the next 2¾ hours talking to her. That was another high spot.
Well, come and listen in to a radio station where the mighty hosts of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
If you want to feel those
why did you do that? Because you were involved in that woman's life?
Well, I certainly wasn't involved in her life. I wasn't going to save her life. If she's reached the stage where she's thinking of putting the gas on and not lighting it, I can get some mileage. It's another conversation. It's another style. It's another shade of the programme. Another shade of the character of the presenter. So it was time to do that. I don't know what the yardstick is, because equally there are times when someone would come on and say, Alan, I'm going to kill myself. And I'd say, have you tried gas? I believe it's quite painless. Get on with it. It's no do with me, pal. So you don't know what makes you decide. You make a instantaneous, irrational judgment, and you're either right or wrong.
But that's a disgraceful thing to do. You're saying to somebody, go ahead and kill yourself.
Well, yeah, it is disgraceful. If a person is so desperate that they ring a jerk on the radio for advice, then the jerk on the radio ain't going to change nothing.
I think, Alan, you're just a rip-off of James Stanley, to tell you the truth, if that's where you got your fame from.
Well, if that's what you think, you're perfectly entitled to think it.
James Stanage, a man who changes stations almost as frequently as he insults callers.
People would phone him going, hello, James, I was wondering if I could have a request for my auntie. She's 73 tomorrow. I go, start off, you boring old cat.
Well, as Jasper Carrot said, James, how come wherever I go, you've just left? I suppose in certain cases, I've been too controversial for the bosses. They think I'm a bit anarchic myself, which I'm not, you know. I'm very sensible, but I love to push the audience to the point of lunacy, where they're thinking, who is this guy? How dare he say that, you know?
Yes, well, who is this guy? He started his phone-in career as Mr. Nasty on Manchester's Piccadilly Radio, and oddly enough, he's back there at the moment. Has he mellowed with age? One of last week's calls hints at the contrary.
We started talking about single mothers. And did they deliberately get themselves pregnant to get a council flat and money, etc., etc.? And I had implied that this would be a silly little tart who should have been sterilised at birth. And about an hour later, this lady came on and she was absolutely blazing, absolutely blazing. So I mean, I just let her blaze herself out, you see. She called me the most offensive man she'd ever heard. Her husband was so upset he'd had to go to bed. I mean, did my head in, but it made wonderful radio. I mean, everybody talked about it for about 3 nights after. Oh, I loved it when that woman had a go at you, Stanage. You deserved that, you know. I think it's great.
Did you deserve that?
The listeners deserve that quality of entertainment.
How distant is Tony Church, Radio Nottingham, Local Worthies and Community Access? We're moving into freak radio circus here, where listeners trot into the ring to be baited by the compere. And people do want to do it. It's weird, offbeat, entertaining. Or is it? Gillian Reynolds is the Daily Telegraph's radio critic.
After a while, the strangeness wears off, and people grow accustomed to their own strangeness. They look at themselves in the electronic mirror, and they think, oh, look at that, I was on Metro last night. And after a while, the self-consciousness of it becomes exhibitionistic.
You can make a star of a regular caller. They're more well-known than me. You know, people make remarks like, oh, it's time you gave up this show, Stanage, give it to Dennis, you know, things like that. People have asked me for photographs of them. Have I met them? What they look like? Have you got his phone number? And I said, oh, no, I can't do anything like that. But we have a little gathering on a Friday evening sometimes in a local bar in Manchester. And it's kind of open house, you know, and we get all sorts of... One of my colleagues here said it looked like the cast of What Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
And if listeners want to be exhibitionist, that's fine, goes the argument for Access Radio. After all, it's their show. In the mid-80s, Tony Blackburn built a huge audience for his morning soul music show on BBC Radio London. A crucial ingredient in its success were phone-in slots, which carried the emotional punch of Friday night dalliances down the disco. Who was fooling who?
Oh, we got people on with a really good sense of humour, actually. They realised and they cottoned on exactly to what I was doing. In other words, I was sending them up. And quite often somebody would answer the phone and say, you know, hello, it's Gladys here. And I would say to them, because I could talk to them off air, I said, well, Gladys, we haven't started yet. They said, oh, sorry, Tone. I didn't realise. So they were sending me off as well, and I was sending them off, and they realised what was happening.
Hello, Tony.
Hello, Sheldon. You sound delicious.
Thank you.
You sound the sort of person I'd like to have been cuddling up with all over the weekend.
Oh, I wouldn't mind that myself, you know, I'm a single person.
We could have watched television in bed.
Oh, that would be nice.
Yeah, I've got loads of videos of some of my past programmes.
Well.
I think the great strength of radio against television is that people who certainly listen into a radio station, they become friends of the broadcaster because the broadcaster is on at the same time every day. Whereas unlike a television programme or a television station, you don't relate to a television station so much because it's far removed from the viewer. Whereas radio is totally different. They do become friends.
We're back to Tony Church's original idea of the phone-in linking different members of the same community. They may tell each other to get lost or flirt outrageously with one another, but occasionally the medium can go beyond that. At the time of the Hillsborough football tragedy, Roger Phillips was hosting a Radio Merseyside phone-in.
We felt there was a need to explain what was going on to people in people's own words, not have the police and the experts and blah, blah, blah doing it, but people being able to say what's happening. So we decided we'd have a phone-in, and we opened the lines at 9. It went until about 1 or 2. It was absolutely clear what the mood of the city was from that, and it was a real emotional mood. And we picked up all kinds of callers from all over the region, people who'd been there, people who, as they'd been travelling back, had been listening. And there's no doubt in my mind that that helped in a small way to keep the city on an even keel.
Hello, Roger.
Hello.
First of all, I have to offer my condolences to the relatives and the friends of the deceased. My point is, those two sets of railings from back to front, Roger, were what caused those deaths today. But that ground is so badly designed. There's only one way in, one massive gate in the centre section, which more or less funnels you in like a cork in a bottle. And once you're in there, you look to your right and you look to your left, and all you can see is two rows of spiked railings. So you think, there's no way out of this.
Fortunately, Hillsboroughs don't happen every day. But on that occasion, the station functioned as a focus for sympathy, information, catharsis. Is the fact that it was local significant? Brian Hayes.
I think they are best local. But I think national makes it difficult because, well, first of all, the mathematics are against you. You know, the sheer volume of calls that you would get across the country and trying to make some kind of sense of that, some kind of balance, almost inevitably means you've got a very artificial mix at the end. You've carefully selected because you've had to carefully select it. I think this must be a problem with Nick Ross's programme. It works very well, as anybody can tell by listening. But I can't help but feel that there's a slightly more artificial nature to it.
Call Nick Ross is Radio 4's prime national phone-in. Its producer is Nick Utekin. Does it, can it, reflect the national mood?
I wouldn't dare to suggest that what I put on every Tuesday is a snapshot of current opinion. It is people who listen to Radio 4. It is people who listen to Radio 4 at that time of the morning. It is people who've got access to a telephone. Already you're reducing various areas of the population immediately. I do try to reflect the views that are genuinely coming in. However, if one's got a topic that the callers that manage to get through, 98% of them are on one side and 2% are on the other, you don't get much of a discussion going. Therefore, I'm in a position, in fact, to be unfair. I can effectively, although the listener won't know, provide an imbalance which does not reflect what is coming in to keep the discussion going and to keep the guests and to keep Nick Ross on his toes.
The phone-in knows no bounds in style, taste or geography. Out in the global village, there is It's Your World, where just about anyone can ring in from anywhere and quiz the leaders of nations. In this instance, Zambia's President Kaunda.
And the next one, President Kaunda, comes from... I can't quite see where it comes from. From Mr. Wesi Kaunda, a name which I imagine Mr. President's familiar to you. And I think must be related to you. It's not exactly a very common name. Mr. Kaunda, where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from York University.
And you mean here in England?
That's right.
And are you related? Are you a family relation of the president?
That's right. He's my father.
Oh, well, you better talk to him. Mr. President, we've got your son here from York University in England.
He's a very much a son.
The global village can be a remarkably parochial place. Good, bad or indifferent, no British phone-in has plumbed the depths discovered in the United States. Shock jocks, like New York's Howard Stern, prove immensely popular by mixing sleaze and innuendo with racism. Will Britain follow suit? Gillian Reynolds.
In America, there has been, and occasionally there still is, a market for the much more deliberately offensive phone-in host than we've ever heard over here. The ones who ask girls the size of their breasts or what they like doing with the whipped cream and the strawberries. And they go on and on about this at great length. And after a while, it even makes Americans feel faintly sick. But the point is, if in some societies, feeling faintly sick might be as near to get as you get to a real feeling all day. God forbid the day when that happens here.
I do think we're too protective in this country, though. I think we're far too protective. I mean, if you take Howard Stern, I think Howard Stern is very adventurous, and what he does, I personally don't think there's anything wrong with it. I would like to see us to be given far more freedom in this country, and I don't see anything wrong in being more adventurous.
Like Tony Blackburn, everyone favours more adventure until they get it, whereupon, as the tabloids would say, switchboards were jammed. And in Britain, perhaps the Howard Sterns would suffer the law of diminishing returns. So maybe do all phone-ins. We began with parish pump announcements over the airwaves and have moved on to gossip over an electronic garden fence. The snag is that such chats may be jolly, but they can go on a bit. And after all, the essence of gossip is that you can comment on the world without changing anything.
I don't think that anymore they're an honest expression of what people feel. It was a radical thing in its day, but that day is a long time ago, and those times are a long time ago, and the currency has become devalued. When we started to have phone-ins, it was a novelty, a rarity. It was your chance to measure up in the same size as Robin Day or Anthony Crossland or, you know, somebody amazing and marvellous. And it's not like that anymore. I mean, now you know that the producer will have his agenda and won't accept your question unless it fits his agenda. And all of the spokesmen have been media trained, and therefore they all evade the point anyway. And you think, oh God, is the world so small and narrow? Are people so pathetic? They can't go out and talk to each other anymore. They've got to lift up the phone and talk to this mythical person at the end of it. They make me quite angry these days.
There is a more optimistic view, and it doesn't start in the studio, but at the other end of the phone line. Roger Phillips.
There are a lot of people with a lot of important views, and we tend to think in media that the only people who know about it are the experts, in inverted commas, and ourselves. And, of course, it's totally untrue, that. And I want to try to break that myth down, because although everyone believes the experts are out there, they're actually here on Merseyside, and they're sitting there listening, and it's just that people don't see them as being experts because they don't have titles and letters after their name. But there are very many very well-read, well-understood, thinking people, and the idea for me of the phone-in is to allow such people to have a platform to let their views be critically examined and let other people hear them and discuss and debate with them what those views are. So trust the experts out there.